We're gonna skate to one song only.
Really kept LSU off balance, which kind of took away their pass rush and their aggressiveness on defense to kind of counter that. And then defensively, I think Alabama played the option very, very well. They took Jefferson out of the game, or that aspect of his game. They just kind of erased that, which without that, Jefferson is a below-average quarterback, and we saw that. So those were the keys of the game to me. And, again, that Alabama defense, I mean, they just showed out.
Eric, what are your thoughts?
You know, very similar thoughts, Phil. Man, the first thing you have to think of as the defense of Alabama was tenacious. I mean, realistically, I haven't seen a defense, I want to say, fly around like that since maybe the 01 Hurricanes. You know, I mean, they were just absolutely outstanding. But I think overall, Alabama was able to beat LSU in all three phases. You know, offensively, very sound, getting the job done. Time of possession was in their favor. Special teams, and then defensively, obviously, they were just far more superior. It was so weird watching it last night because it seemed like LSU offense was just totally overmatched by that Alabama defense. I mean, every time Jefferson got the ball, he had three or four guys, you know, on his heels as soon as he said hi. You know, on the play where he took the ball and tried to run up the middle and make a play and threw it to the defender. I mean, it was just nonstop attack. It was just attack, attack, attack. And they weren't prepared for it.
And one of the criticisms that Les Miles has received is his ability to make some in-game decisions. Offensively, they looked like they could not really they didn't really have a golf gift. I was, you know, I was going back and forth with people on Twitter and doing Facebook last night. And one of the things I said about the SEC, elite defenses, but below average offensive play and quarterback play in terms of skill. And you know, I was just surprised that LSU offense didn't have any kind of adjustments in the match. I have to give Saban some credit. What he did with their offense and what their offensive coordinator did was amazing. I think they made great adjustments. But it just seemed like they didn't make any kind of in-game adjustments to LSU. I mean, what do y'all think about that? I'll throw it to Phil.
I was looking for LSU to maybe make a change at quarterback at halftime to maybe throw a different wrinkle at Alabama, similar to what they did in the first game when they went away from the kid that started the game and they went to Jefferson in the second half. It was just enough to kind of win in the regular season game. But when they showed the stat that over the past 2 years or the past two games, and I can't remember the other quarterback's name, he's thrown one touchdown and seven interceptions, I'm like, okay, Les is doing a good job staying with Jefferson here. but I would have liked to see Jefferson roll out more, get him on the run. They treated him like a pocket passer, and watching this kid over the last 2 years, he's anything but that. So I agree. I wish LSU's offensive coordinator at Miles would have made some different adjustments.
It was almost like, you know, kind of like Elway told Tebow to let it fly. It was almost like they wouldn't let Jefferson let it fly. And they had Lee over there just kind of looking like he was going to come in stretching and doing all the other stuff. And they never, you know, there's certain things you got to do when you only have one game left. And it didn't seem like they did anything to kind of spark the offense, anything that kind of let it go. I mean, they got across the 50, once, twice, you know, four plays across the 50. I mean, that right there says something about it. You know, so, Eric, what do you think about some of those in-game adjustments issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Nick Saban, I mean, we've got to give this guy a lot of credit here. He made the proper adjustments from the first meeting to this one. He had his team prepared. And, I mean, realistically, and I don't know how often you guys have talked about this, but this layoff in between regular season and his national championship game has to play to the defensive advantage, and not just the Alabama, you know, defensive advantage. But if you just think about the NFL, and you know, we say in week 17 you rest your starters, and you've got the 1 week the bye week coming up, so you got 2 weeks of rest time. You know, teams are coming in rusty. Now these guys are off 44 days and 37 days. I mean, these are college kids. These aren't professionals. You know what college kids are doing with 44 days of rest. they're having a lot of fun. So I mean, mentally, there's a lot of challenges that are going on for kids to be out for 44 days and then having to come back and get a grip to this high-tane defense and try to be able to contain it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, and you've seen that on and on. Even last year, you saw the slow starts with two high-powered offenses, you know, that, you know, as they start to have a discussion about where they're going to go with this BCS, which is interesting that we have all this chatter going on. You know, you got Delaney now, the Big Ten, which was one of the big major holdouts, you know, now interested in having a conversation. But that layoff is a big thing. Whatever format they have, they have to address the layoff. You know, it's just – these are creatures of habit. These are folks who are used to a schedule. And then when you disrupt it for that length of time, and like you said, with these being college football players, you know, you're going to have problems with timing and things like that in a way that defensively you don't have problems with it. Given what you said, Eric, let's think about this. Does that even say Saban, give Saban even more credit because his offense was even better than it was the last time they played? I mean,
yes.
What do you think about that?
I mean, I read something online just kind of talking about the tweaks that he did to his offense and the tweaks that he did to the schedule with the time being off, not sticking to the exact same format because, again, you've got all this long layoff. You've got to do some changes. You know, you got to maybe practice a little bit more or do certain things. I don't remember exactly what he did, but he made quite a bit of changes going into this last game as far as the practice schedule. So, I mean, I think Nick Saban deserves all the credit in the world for what he's able to do. You know, where he goes, titles follow. You know, it's just all to it. I mean, you know, not much you can say to it. I mean, it's the record that he puts up. I mean, championships go where he goes, so he has to get a lot of credit.
Yeah.
Phil, go ahead.
I can't help but think, what would have happened had he stayed at Michigan State?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and for those that forget, it's somewhat easy to forget, this guy was the head coach of Michigan State, you know, for 4 or 5 years before he went to LSU. So, you know, then after LSU, you know, he won a championship at LSU, went to Miami. That was an issue. Not the greatest of experiences for him. Then he ended up at Alabama. But, I mean, Eric brings up a good point. This guy knows how to recruit. He knows how to get the most out of these 4- and 5-star athletes where they can be stacked at certain positions. I mean, on his defensive line, he's going 6 deep with defensive ends.
Yeah.
And all these kids were either 4- or 5-star recruits. That takes quite a skill to keep all these kids happy and motivated to play at this high level.
Yeah, he's definitely the right coach for Alabama. You know, I always talk about that Big Ten influence. You got Les Miles and you got Saban, who are, you know, basically Big Ten folks who are down there, you know, instilling some of that stuff that was important in Big Ten in the 80s, in the early 90s, around that running game, that defense. That's very important. Now, you know, they're taking that philosophy and putting it against with these elite athletes and what you're seeing. I mean, a commitment to the run, that physical play that they have up there, and he's running that pro-style defense. I mean, he made some adjustments last night. I mean, what was interesting is how they attacked the Honey Badger. Like, he became a really good part of the program in terms of how they attacked him. And that was, you know, in some ways that demoralizes you when you go at one of your marquee players. And so I thought that was a really good strategy by them, is sometimes going after the heart of their defense, one of the heart and soul of their defense. They went after him a couple of times. Eric, talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the play at Alabama quarterback and just kind of like you know, what you saw in terms of how they attacked that LSU defense.
Yeah. You know, I thought they did an excellent job at starting him out with some short passes to get him comfortable. You know, I thought that they got a rhythm going early. And he's the kind of guy, due to his lack of experience, that you want to get, you know, that rhythm going early to get him comfortable. And when he began to get comfortable, then obviously, you know, here comes the running game. Now you've got the two-headed monster. Now you've got problems. And I think on the reverse end with LSU, Jefferson could never get comfortable because they wouldn't allow him to. I mean, you know, realistically, again, Nick Saban did an excellent job in his offensive coordinator of getting that the quarterback comfortable and keeping the flow of the game within his hands, not looking for him to do too much. You know, just keeping it nice and comfortable into his hands, not allowing him to do too much, just a nice, comfortable game plan.
Yeah, and I thought, and you could see him growing up. You know, you have these moments, and you could see him growing up as the game progressed. You could see his confidence, his leadership, going as he started making some throws. You know, it opened up the running game a little bit. They looked like they were throwing off balance. You know, just amazing set of just, you know, the nature of play calling, the art of play calling and setting somebody up was on display there. As you start to think about Saban's legacy, you know, where do you put him? You know, I heard people say he's still number two to Bear Bryant, but, you know, where do you put Saban in terms of, you know, we have Urban Meyer coming back. Where do you rank Saban in terms of coaches in America right now with this victory? For Eric.
Yeah, I've got to put Saban right at the top. I apologize. I got to put him right at the top. You know, I do struggle with comparing different eras. You know, I struggle the same way with NBA, struggle with Red Auerbach and Phil Jackson. You know, you got to struggle with the Bear Bryant and the Nick Saban. But as far as our modern day time, I mean, I got to put him right up there at the top. And until another coach is able to do what he has been able to do, again, the success that comes along with where he goes from Michigan State to LSU to Alabama, it's just success, success, success.
Eric, you didn't run us. I'm gonna run it. Since you are, you know, you one of our RSG analysts. I'm gonna keep going with this line of conversation with you. Les Miles, what appears to be his legacy? When you think about how he approached the game last night, what's going on? How do you feel about Les in terms of where he is, in terms of coaching and his legacy, in terms of how his team performed last night?
Yeah, you know, I still think he's a phenomenal coach. He was definitely out-coached last night, and you're going to run across instances where, you know, you've got your Clyde Drexler versus Michael Jordan, you know, your Patrick Ewing versus Jordan, where they probably would have won if Jordan, that doggone 23 guy, wasn't in the house. But, I mean, Les Miles is a heck of a coach. He's always in the thick of things. His team is well-prepared. I know last night wasn't a good example of a team being prepared, but I mean, bottom line, they were just outmatched, outclassed. That was one of the poorest games that I've seen out of a Les Miles team. And I don't know if that was because the overwhelming superiority of the Bama defense, or it was just he did not coach these, you know, 37 days off properly. Not sure, but his legacy does take a hit. You know, you're going up against the best in Nick Saban, and you're right there with him. So the more you lose, again, that kind of puts Nick Saban on a higher pedestal.
And you know, one of the things that I, you know, when I think about, you know, Les Miles and what he brings to the table for it, that, you know, he's a phenomenal recruiter. He's not afraid to schedule competitive games. If you think about the number of teams that they beat in terms of, you know, way up there in West Virginia, beating Oregon, beating Georgia in the Georgia Dome, beating Alabama, Oscar, and Tuscaloosa, you know, doing all those different things that are important, he continues to challenge the team and his program, and I think that helps with recruitment. When you think about the national championship, Eric, in terms of this year and now the chatter that folks are having about, you know, changing format and, you know, doing something different, you know, where do you see this BCS going now that you're beginning to hear some of this chatter? What's the format for you that's working? You know, obviously people had some change. You know, Alabama proved, it, you know, I've been the biggest critic of this, but,
yeah.
you know, Alabama, I think the way they won last night put a lot to bed, but it's still, for me, it's hard when you don't win your division, you don't play the conference championship game. There's some things about that that just doesn't seem like it fits. Now that this chatter is going on, where do you see the next phase of the BCS going?
You know, I actually think that probably in the next year or so, I think they're going to move to – they're going to try to appease the majority, and they're going to move to some sort of playoff format. But it's not going to be, in my opinion, I don't think it's going to be everything that we want, but it's going to be a start. So I think they're going to move more toward the four-team playoff format, and then you get the one national game between the, you know, so it's going to be the one versus four, two versus three, and then though that winner of those two games play each other for the championship. I think that's where they're going to go with this next change. Again, they've got a ton of BCS games out there, so I don't think they want to necessarily lose the amount of endorsements and money that is bringing into the collegiate level. And that kind of rolls into what our guest is going to talk about, that beast of NCAA right now, football. But so I think that's going to be the first thing they do is roll into maybe a four-team format. And then even by going to that, we're still going to hear, oh, well, number five or number six could have been into number four. But it's a step into the right direction. And I think eventually we'll be at more of a playoff type of scenario, more similar to the college basketball breakdown, but not all the way to 64. I mean, you know, we may get on out to 10 and then maybe 15, something like that. But I definitely see them moving toward at least that 4+1.
And you know, and one of the things I think you hit on is that this balance between the benefits you get from the bowls. And a lot of people talk about the money that they get from playing in the bowl. But what people don't really understand is what's being leveraged by that bowl experience with key alumni, donors, and that. If you ever look at a bowl league, you know, one of my alma maters is Northern Illinois. They just played in the GoDaddy.com bowl. I mean, the number of emails that I was getting about activities, promotions leading up to the game and how those create opportunities for giving for the institution around that is incredible. And so, you know, part of it is finding for them that balance between producing a champion that everybody can embrace, but at the same time, like you said, you know, being able to still benefit from that bold experience. And that's a tough balance to have when you look at that. That's something that's tough to get. So, you know, I think you hit a key point as it relates to that. What would you think about the impact of that on, again, you talked about the layoff. As I start to think about the format, you know, you add in, you know, 14, you have the playoffs. We just talked about layoff. In some ways, it helps to, it still gives those teams in the championship game a little less of a, you know, kind of a transition because they have at least 1 week between games, but are you concerned about how that might push things out a little bit?
Yeah, that's always a concern. Again, I mean, looking at the numbers, all you can do if you see 30, 40 days off, you have to be concerned. I mean, I don't know how you could be a fan of the sport and not be concerned about a 40-day layoff. If in the NFL, we're concerned about a 2-week layoff going into the playoffs. So, you know, with that being said, pushing that extra time into it could be an issue, so there's got to be a way to kind of work that around. And I don't necessarily know how they're going to get to the point to do that, but if you're going to take that time off and extend it by another 7 days, now you're up to 50 days. I mean, you know, that time is going to be huge, so that's going to be a fine line. I think that may be one of the reasons that they're continuing to have issues trying to work with this playoff system is to make sure we don't have this extended delay and try to reduce the delay.
Well, you know, we've unpacked a lot of the undercurrents around this BCS, and we have a special guest with us tonight. He's a professor of management and director of the Institute for Sports Management at the University of New Haven. He's also the co-author of College Athletes for Hire, The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA's Amateur Myth. He's the co-founder of the Drake Group, who is mission is to help faculty and staff defend the academic integrity in the face of a burgeoning college sports industry. He is the author of Counterfeit Amateurs, an Athlete's Journey Through the 60s to the Age of Academic Capitalism. He brings together really in this book both his own compelling story about his own experience as a highly recruited college, a high school athlete who played at Notre Dame and on their national championship team with the legendary coach Eric Parseghian. But he's really, I think, over the past couple years, or past few years, since the 60s, been recognized as a scholar activist that really is really challenging what he calls the academic capitalism of the system under the current NCAA rules. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, the RSG World, Dr. Alan Sack. Dr. Sack, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks a lot for asking me to be on.
I greatly appreciate it.
We were just talking about the BCS championship game. Did you have a chance to watch that at all?
Just now I caught the end. And who was the person you were talking to?
I was talking to Eric Hamilton, who's one of our guests here on one of our co-hosts here on the show, along with Phil, who you know, about the championship game. So we were having a little conversation about that. But you caught the end of the championship game?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought what I just heard him say was he was talking about the long lull between your last game in the fall and when you finally play in your bowl game.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, goodness,
yes.
Last night I've never seen a more pathetic offense in my entire life. And I don't think that I really don't believe that LSU was that bad. But I was also thinking, God, hell, if you haven't been playing and pushing and really hitting hard and you're kind of just sitting back waiting for this game, you can kind of lose that edge. And I don't know why Alabama didn't lose its edge, but boy, LSU did.
And I think you hit it, losing the edge and having that time. The layoff was kind of incredible. And part of what we're talking about is really what this BCS system has done to even the flow of games. Most people don't know or may not know that you played at a high level. You played at Notre Dame in the 60s. What was your experience like as an athlete being recruited? And, compared to what you saw last night, what was your experience, being recruited by Notre Dame and competing in the 60s as an athlete?
All right. Before I hit that question, I'll hit it in a second. I did want to mention one other thing about that game last night. Although the offense of LSU was really anemic, I really think you have to hand it to them for their defense hanging in as long as they did. And that relates to my being on the defensive end at Notre Dame. When you're in a game that long, and I don't think I ever was in a game that long, these guys hung in there, and they didn't let them score. They had 5 field goals, and that could have been like 35-0, and it was really 15-0. And then at the end, they finally crumbled, which is understandable because every time it was just one and out for the offense. So I had nothing but kudos and cheers for the defense. It was a great defensive game on both sides. It's just that LSU fell apart on the offense. Notre Dame, fantastic experience for me, and a real privilege actually to play for a team like that. First of all, the caliber of people that I had a chance to play with. Alan Page, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but played for the Minnesota Vikings. He's now the Associate Justice for the Supreme Court in Minnesota, played on the Minnesota Vikings on at least 3 or 4 teams that went to the Super Bowl. Number one, got a lot of came close a lot of times. Rocky Blyer, who was who played in Vietnam. I mean, he fought in Vietnam after his career in college. That was back in the late 60s, early 70s, and had part of his leg blown away, and actually came back and played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he has quite a few Super Bowl rings. Terry Hanratty, Jim Seymour, Jim Lynch, all my other buddies. And I was kind of like a backup defensive end to Alan Page, who was an All-American, and I feel proud to even have the damn uniform on. So from that point of view, I am very, very happy to have played there. My coach was fantastic, Eric Parseghian. And what was it like to play there? It doesn't even compare. This year was our 45th reunion of our national championship football team. And we all went back to South Bend. The whole team was there, pep rally, the whole deal. And I do remember it hit me as they dragged us out there in wheelchairs and stuff onto the field. And everybody cheered. And I looked around at the crowd and thinking about the stands, which are much, you know, far more seats than there were when I was there. And I was really reflecting on how much it has changed. We had no freshman football when I played at Notre Dame, and most of the players did want to play. They wanted to play as freshmen, and you could be a Phi Beta Kappa. I mean, you could have a 4.0 average. You could have gone to Oxford, you know, and been a Rhodes Scholar. You stood and played as a freshman, so which drove home the point. They didn't have to call us student athletes. They didn't really use that term that much, but we knew we were students because they wouldn't let us play. And they wouldn't let us play because they wanted us to make an adjustment to college. And here's one, I don't know if you know this or not, but we won the national championship by playing Michigan State, but it was a tie, but we had one more game left, so we played Southern Cal and really slaughtered them, I guess 51-0. The point was that we won the national championship without going to a bowl game because in 1966-67, Notre Dame and there were other schools as well who simply did not believe that it was in the academic interest of the athletes to go to a bowl game because we had final exams and we had things we had to take care of toward the end of that semester, the first semester. And such a notion is absolutely inconceivable, you know, in the minds of the average American today. You guys are sitting there talking about playoffs. Man, when I was playing, the team wanted to go to a bowl game. They just wouldn't let us go to a bowl game because, you know, sports were something that you did to enhance your total education. It didn't overwhelm your education, and I think that's really an important point. And the final thing I want to mention, and this will lead in, I hope, in the next 15 minutes, 20, whatever we're talking, the notion that when I was recruited in high school, I was recruited by, I'd say, approximately 100 different schools and with all kinds of scholarship offers. And teams, coaches from University of Pittsburgh or Notre Dame and others who had come to my house, you know the experience. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that whole thing in your families or yourselves. You were highly recruited. But when they came to my house, they were able to say that to my mom and dad, Mr. and Mrs. Sack, that if your son comes to our school, your son is there for 4 years, and even if he turns out to be a recruiting mistake, and we know he's not going to be, we think he's going to be a Heisman Trophy winner, but even if he ends up not being as good as you thought, he still has his scholarship at Notre Dame, at Pitt, at Duke, wherever they were from when they were recruiting me. And I thought that was, my parents thought that was really a great thing, because Notre Dame was saying that they were committed to me as a student and as a human being, and not as a commodity that could be traded from one school to another or run off or fired, so to speak, or take your scholarship away if you're injured. And I was guaranteed my education if I were injured as well. And so, again, to put it in context, and you asked me about my Notre Dame experience, I truly do feel privileged to have played at a time when I think the priorities, although, come on, there was cheating back then too, you know, all over the place. But they did still care about us. And why shouldn't today's college athletes have the same kinds of privileges? Why can't the modern-day kid who goes to a big-time school also, and I know the NCAA is making some efforts to go back in that direction, but why can't they have the kind of educational experience that I had in general? So that's it. I just wanted to make that point about Notre Dame and the comparison.
And I love that. And Alan, and part of that, you can, even talking about the fact that you won a national championship and didn't win a bowl game, and you mentioned the Michigan State game, which is referred to as the first mega game of modern television era. Can you talk about that? The three folks who are on the air with you, you know, we weren't alive during that time. We didn't see that. But it really launched kind of a new era between television and college sports. Can you talk a little bit about that game?
Yeah, you make a very good point, by the way, that whole idea of that 1966 game. We were just on the cusp in big-time college sports of moving into the television era. And some people have written about that game and said that may have been symbolic of the crossing the line The game was televised in Vietnam to our troops. So obviously telecommunications has become far more sophisticated than ever. You can broadcast all over the place. Supposedly it was had the highest Nielsen rating or the television rating of any college football game ever at that point in time. So what does that mean? People who are watching that, who have media savvy, people in the networks and the sponsors and so forth that are saying, my God, all those people are watching that one game. It's almost like a Super Bowl of that area. You know, they're all watching this one game. Man, could we sell some products if we get ourselves associated with that? And so people were not naive. They knew that that kind of connection was there between sports and commodification and commercialism. But that game drove home how much progress had been made in terms of the television era and the idea of being able to penetrate new markets by extending your reach through your athletic program at the big-time level so that you could reach into Dallas, you could reach into New York City, you could actually have conferences that, and they start making decisions in terms of market share more so than in anything that has to do with the students, I mean the athletes' student interests. So, yeah, that was a tie. It's very controversial. People have been beating up on my coach, who's now about 86 years old, Ara Parsegian. He never got over that in the final minutes of that game, and some of your older listeners right now will recall it. Toward the end of that game, there was no tiebreaker back then, and it was 10-10. The wind was blowing in our face. I'm going to give you a justification here, and people are going to say, hey, that's bullshit. But it was. It was, and our starting quarterback had just been injured. Terry Hanratty, so had the backup quarterback in there, Coley O'Brien. And this all happened, and our starting center, George Gedeke, was injured, and he was in the game. There's 2 minutes left in the game. Now you got your backup center, you got your backup quarterback, and our All-American running back, Nagetti, I'm not making this up, he's getting off the train in Lansing, Michigan, before the game, and he already had a slight injury in his shoulder, but he fell against the side. I don't know if they're on a train. I don't know if they still have them, but an iron handle you could hold as you're balancing yourself to get down the steps. And he tripped and slid on the step, and it's unbelievable. He fell right into that. I was in backup. I saw him fall right into that thing and hit his shoulder, so he didn't play in that game either. So picture this. Very windy. It's a tie game. You've got the ball on your own 30-yard line. There's now a minute and a half left in the game, and you've got all these kind of rookies in your backfield. The worst thing that could happen to you is you're going to fumble, you're going to screw up, you're going to throw an interception, and they have a guy named Bob Apiza or something, I've forgotten the exact name, but he was fantastic, one of the first guys to kick with the soccer style. People used to do extra points with their toe, and now he was and barefoot. Fantastic. So Ara, to kind of get right to the point. Did he just go? Did he tie one for the Gipper? That's what I always say about him. He tied one for the Gipper instead of winning one for the Gipper. And he did keep the ball on the ground for a couple of plays. All right, and he didn't really go for it with a bomb. He was holding off on that until maybe 30 seconds left, 20 seconds left, so he could throw a long pass, get into the field goal range, and kick the field goal and win the game. But it didn't go that way. Ran the ball three times, off tackle. People started to boo. They were booing in the stands, I remember it very clearly. And then he tried to throw the long pass, and Coley O'Brien was sacked. The quarterback was sacked, and it ended, and there wasn't a sound. There wasn't a sound in the stadium in the supposed game of the century. People were stunned that it was a tie. It ends in a tie. You couldn't cheer. You couldn't cry. Some people did. Walked over and shook hands with the other guys from Michigan State, and they were pissed off, and we were pissed off, and now who's going to be national champion? And they made us national champion. So if you want to see the seeds of much that you see today about the issue of playoffs, I mean, you can see a little kernel of that. People want to know who's winning, who's the best team in the country, and they don't want the Associated Press
playoffs?
To be the ones.
Don't talk about playoffs. Are you kidding me?
That's the point. That's the point. We won, and the Associated Press gave it to us. And to this day, I'll be honest with you, Michigan State has just as much of a claim as anybody else.
What's interesting about what you talk about is we start to see this kernel going on, but it's also, kind of the backdrop for this is kind of the unrest that's happening in the 60s. And I know in your book you talk about kind of the uprising and the unrest in the 60s and the impact of that on sports. Can you talk about, in the midst of that, you also had on your campuses all this activity in which athletes were involved in some of this. What impact did that unrest of the 60s begin to have on kind of changing the landscape of college sports?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And if you go to that 10-10 tie, Michigan State, that's related to what you're talking about in a sense that at Notre Dame in 1966, we had one black football player on the team. One. His name was Alan Page, and I think he's one of the finest, arguably one of the finest football players ever to play in the pros even, you know, all pro Alan Page. But we played Michigan State, and honest to God, Michigan State had just about a, it wasn't a totally black starting team, but it was close to it. Bubba Smith and a lot of others, Mike Webster, there were, and so Michigan State was already into the recruitment of black athletes, and some other schools, maybe Syracuse and some others, were starting to do that, and they were becoming, they were winning. Okay, so already you started to have more of an influx of the black athletes into college sports. However, in the Southeast Conference in 1971, and this is hard to believe, and maybe people know this, but in 1971 there was not one black football player in the Southeast Conference, not one. And it was simply just a segregated system. And by 1971, 73, 74, and I think it's because of the television, all of a sudden the Bear Bryants of the world and the others and from the South start to realize, hey, if we're going to win, we better get these black athletes in here. So you see a shift. Now, to get directly to your point, 1968, most tumultuous year of my younger life. You know, President Kennedy's assassinated, and Martin Luther King, not Kennedy, that's earlier on, but Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there we had the, in Vietnam War, there was the Tet Offensive. There were a lot of things that happened in that year, assassination of Bobby Kennedy, not Teddy Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and so other things were happening. And one of the other things that many people don't realize even today is 1968 was also the Mexico City Olympics. Yes. And the Mexico City Olympics are famous because of John Carlos and Tommy Smith walking out there onto the stand for the medal ceremony and standing and putting their hand in the air with a black glove salute. And this is amazing. I teach, you know, in a college university, and in the dormitories, you will still see that, you'll see that poster on the walls in kids' rooms. And I asked the kids in my class, some of whom actually had that poster, what that represents. They don't know. they think it's a cool picture of these two guys out there with a black black guys with their hand up in a black salute for black power. But they really don't know what black power was all about. But what it really meant was these athletes were part of an attempted boycott of the 1968 Olympics that was led by Harry Edwards, San Jose University professor. And Harry was really organizing, trying to organize a worldwide boycott by people of color of the Olympics, especially in the United States. And the argument is this, and I don't know if your listeners want to buy into this, but they were saying, these kids were saying, why should we be winning medals for the United States and really bringing all this prestige to the United States? And this is true even back to the 1936 Olympics with Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens comes back, and these guys, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, try to go to a hotel, and they don't let him stay there because they're black. They go home in their cities in the southern states and even in the northern states, and they're treated like second-class citizens. Black guys coming home from Vietnam, giving their lives for this country, who don't have equal opportunity in any aspect of life in America. And so here is this. You can sell products through sports, right, as we talked about earlier, but you can sell politics through sports too. And by you know a lot of people are watching, so they walked out there, and they really did give up their medals and the other acclaim they could have had, and they were, after they protested, they were let out of the Olympics, and they were kicked out of the Olympics, and they really generated, the response to that was that on college campuses throughout the United States, black athletes started protesting, and in 1969, 70, 71, real outbreaks of revolt, the revolt of the black athlete is what Harry Edwards' book is actually called. and it has substantial consequences for the integration of athletes on athletic teams on, in college campuses, as well as on the college campuses in general. No doubt about that. Where Syracuse University, I'll give you this one example, Syracuse University in 1971, I think they might have had 9 players who simply refused to play until, well, it was a Schwartzwalder, I guess. Ben Schwartzwalder was their coach. And on the coaching staff, it was common to call a black athlete, boy, hey, boy, get over here. They had a predominantly black team at Syracuse at that time, and there were no black cheerleaders, no women cheerleaders, no men cheerleaders that were black. My students just don't believe this stuff because they can't believe it could possibly be like that or it could have been like that, but it was like that. Black athletes and white athletes were segregated in their housing. You know, the football players, can you imagine black and white athletes were not allowed to live together? So these 9 athletes said, until these things are fixed, we're not going to play. And so they boycotted the games. They lost their scholarships, and they never did get back. Most of them never got back to playing or ever getting a letter anywhere in football until, I guess, 2006. The provost at Syracuse University invited them back. This is really a touching thing. I think they were called the Syracuse 9 or whatever, and these guys never really, some of them never got degrees either. And they were invited back, and they got their letter jackets, honorary letter jackets, finally in this game against, I can't remember who they played in the Big East, but that happened. So I think what this shows, and it really, I think, proves in many ways, the University of Louisville is who it was. I think what it shows is that when athletes band together, as they did then, and the black athletes did it, and there were some white athletes too at Notre Dame who joined in these kind of boycotts on behalf of civil rights and even the war in Vietnam. But when athletes and on our campuses pull together and join together, they can make tremendous. That may be one of the biggest reforms in college sports ever. And it was really a consequence of the black athletes who had really spearheaded this movement to say, wait a minute, we're opening up these universities to people of color. And so I think it's people don't give that enough emphasis. I believe that was a major turning point. And it was done not by sitting there and talking it out in bureaucratic kind of meetings with the NCAA and just year after year hearing the same old, same old. They said, hey, we're not going to play. And that really brought some change. But as with all changes, a couple of those athletes got thrown under the bus. And it took many, many years to come back. And they never really had their college athletic careers, but they felt on principle that was really important.
When you think about, coming out of that in terms of what things actually laid the groundwork for professionalism in college sports, what would you say are the one or two kinds of events that kind of laid the groundwork for what you would say is professionalism of college sports?
Well, obviously, the coaches weren't particularly happy about this stuff, athletes boycotting, walking away and saying we're not going to play. 1967, a rule was passed, not a coincidence. A rule was passed. It was called the Fraudulent Misrepresentation Rule. And what that rule said was that if you voluntarily withdraw from sports or if you defy your coach, they can take away your scholarship immediately. Because at that time, and when I played at Notre Dame, I had that 4-year scholarship I told you about. That was guaranteed. 1967, they said, it's not guaranteed anymore. If you are not going to go along with what your coach says, or if you're going to cause trouble, or if you're going to boycott in some way or other and be involved in politics, we can take away your scholarship. And if anybody out there is in the NCAA or is interested in this stuff, just go back to your NCAA manual, and you will find that the fraudulent misrepresentation rule is still there. And that's when it came into existence. Another couple of years went by, and what the fraudulent misrepresentation rule allowed you to do was get rid of a kid who, was really not following rules, or if he just walked away. And many people would say, you can see where there may be some justice to that. You have an athletic scholarship, and you just go out there and kind of take a nap under the goalpost during practice. You know, I mean, you should probably don't deserve. I don't know, but. That's what that did, but you still couldn't get rid of a kid who was a recruiting mistake. Deadwood, All right? And you still couldn't really just take that scholarship away because they weren't playing well enough or because they're injured. 1973 is what my book, Counterfeit Amateurs, is all about. And one reviewer, I guess, just missed the entire point, had no idea what the hell I was talking about. That's what the book's about. My basic criticism is this 1973 rule, which said that if the player does not really perform to the coach's expectations and follow every rule and every directive, and if they, even if they're injured, that you can take away their scholarship. And my argument is that that transformed these athletes. It was a fairly slow transformation from being kind of amateurs before 1956 when it was need-based financial aid into kind of professionals when they started giving athletic scholarships. But finally in 1973, literally, and here's where many of your listeners, and I go for this argument all the time, I argue literally they turned into employees. There's an offer, there's an acceptance, there's a consideration, that's a contract. So the one-year renewable scholarship says that we have a contractual relationship and you're going to play the way I want you to play and you're going to do what I want you to do. I'm taking away your room, board, tuition, and fees. I'm going to fire you. Okay? That's an employment a relationship. And if it is, and here's the rest of my book, is if you turn these kids into employees, you have no right to limit the amount of compensation that they get. This is free. You guys want to play free enterprise? You know, if the university can go out there and sell its product to the highest bidder, you know, if every person on campus who can write a business plan can go out there and make money from college sports, you're going to treat these kids like criminals for, you know, taking a hamburger from an alumnus? This is bullshit. So my book is really saying here that when you transform these kids into professional athletes, which they did in 1973, and I continue to argue it, and if the law doesn't yet accept that, certainly the objective conditions of what an athlete faces today are like employment. It's hard to separate them from employment. You are controlled from the time you get up to the time you go to bed. There is no other merit award winner on campus. The guy who plays the violin or woman who plays the violin or whomever in the orchestra on campus does not go through what the big-time college athlete does in terms of having their life controlled. And they're controlled because they can, in fact, be fired if they don't go along with the program. And therefore, hey, they should get workers' compensation if they go to court after that. They should be able to ask for certain kind of benefits and so on and so forth. And if you want to expand on that discussion, I'd be glad to. But I think that was laying the foundation. If you're going to build an industry, and that's what it is, big-time college sports, multi-million-dollar industry, you can't do that with amateurs, honestly. You have to have kids. You have to have a pliable and controllable workforce. And the way you got that workforce is by introducing the one-year renewable scholarship, because now you have a way of firing and hiring and controlling and getting what you really want to win national championships.
This is great. We're with Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. I have my co-host here that would love to ask some questions. We're going to push it over to Phil. Phil, I know you have some questions you'd like to talk to Alan about. Phil, why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
Absolutely. So while I was reading your book, one of the things that stuck out to me, Dr. Sack, is you talked about in 1989 you did a survey that you conducted with the support of the NFL Players Association. Can you talk a little bit about that survey and some of your findings that you talked about in your book?
Well, first of all, 1989, Ed Garvey was the director of the National Football League Players Association, and in the 1980s I had been involved in an organization called the Center for Athletes' Rights and Education, and we were trying to get the kind of rights that I was just talking about, the right for athletes to have the same kind of benefits that workers have, right? So I got to know the people at the NFL Players Association quite well, Gene Upshaw and the whole crew. Ed Garvey was the director. There's a different kind of mood down there then, I sense, than today. I mean, there was still some of that activism left over from the 70s and 80s, and the athletes were still thinking in terms of athletes' rights rather than simply my right to make $1 billion no matter what. You know, it was kind of a feeling of, hey, there's a fairness issue involved here. We want a percentage of the gross. We're going to go on strike. We're going to organize. So that's I got involved with that whole thing and knew the people there, and I said, geez, I was asked to go to California, I guess, to Stanford University or a think tank just outside of Stanford. And the NCAA and some other people were trying to put together a survey of college athletes to examine a wide variety of issues around education and big-time college sports. And I went out there and I said, geez, you know one of the biggest issues regarding education here? The fact that these athletes have been turned into employees, and therefore they're not able to really spend the time getting the education that they were promised, that they have to take their orders, so to speak, from the coach. Their priority is trying out and keeping my scholarship for the next year. I can't be worried about how I'm doing in the classroom except for eligibility. So I thought that was a key issue. The people from, like, NCAA backgrounds and stuff who were in this group meeting kind of thought I was nuts or something, making that point, and they refused. I said, no, we should put some questions in this questionnaire about the day-to-day living conditions of being a college athlete. We should ask them, what is their attitude toward the athletic scholarship? Does it really cover their full needs? Should college athletes be able to have compensation beyond what the current NCAA rules allow? And one that really knocked them out, I said, why don't we put in there and ask them if they've ever taken money under the table or if they've ever really been in that situation? By the way, I think the fact that athletes take money under the table and are treated like criminals, I think that is a real crime in itself, that they deserve what they get, and they shouldn't be treated like prostitutes or something for getting the kind of compensation that they really deserve. Anyway, they refused to include my questions. They went ahead with the survey. It was okay, and there were some interesting findings from it. But I said, I'm going to do my own, damn it. So I got a hold of my friends at the NFLPA. I asked them if I could send out my own survey. And it was really cool. They said, yeah. And they allowed me to use their mailing. You know, I didn't have access to the names, but I sent them my survey, and I put them all in envelopes and stuff, very primitive. We didn't have Survey Monkey and stuff like that like they have today, computers. This was like in individual envelopes I sent out these surveys. And they sent them out to about over 2,000 NFL ballplayers and former NFL ballplayers, and I was just dumbfounded that it actually got off the ground, you know. They sent it out, and I think I went off skiing for spring break or something. I had an opportunity to go with my sons, came back, and my God, I went to my mailbox, and the mailbox was like overflowing. I couldn't believe these guys actually sent these things back.
Yeah.
And if my mailbox was full, and they said, no, wait a minute, come on back here. Not only was my mailbox full, but they had boxes full of these envelopes coming back from NFL ballplayers. 1,200 or so actually responded. And what I found was that like 70% of these guys saw nothing whatsoever wrong with taking money that went beyond what the NCAA really allows. I found in the Southwest Conference that about, I think it was probably 50 or 60% of the athletes admitted having taken money under the table. In the Southwest,
wow.
In the Southwest Conference, which this is back in 1989 now we're talking about, right? In the Southwest Conference, which doesn't exist anymore, but they were just a renegade kind of outfit out there. And
SMU. Yeah,
that's right, SMU. That whole crew, the governor's involved giving money to the ball players, right? And they see nothing wrong with it. Honest, to this day, they still don't see anything wrong with it. I actually get talks down in the South sometimes, and they agree with me down in Alabama that the athletes should be paid. But anyway, this one guy from, I don't know where he was from, I know he's from the Southwest Conference, he said he had part in interest in an oil well for going to one school or other. So I was blown away. Of course, the NCAA and this guy named is it Swofford, who's still the commissioner of the Southeast Conference, I think. But I think one of the same guys is in place. But at that time, he says, this is crazy. You know, this is a bad sample. It's poor research. Ask the wrong guys. You want to ask the best football players. And that's only a small group. The rest of them who don't go into the pros would not answer the same way. But regardless, I did get many, many athletes who were very cynical. And to tell you the truth, the most cynical were the African-American athletes. and I was asked by the New York Times, why was it that the African American athletes were more likely to say they felt that the rules should, that you should be allowed to have greater benefits than the rules allow, than did the white athletes? And my answer was simple, and I said that I think African Americans historically are more familiar with rule systems and legal systems that give them very little for the kind of work that they put into an effort. For God's sake, go back to slavery, and then after slavery, and even until today, you still have these differentials between African Americans and others, and things have improved dramatically in many, many ways. But certainly in the 60s, it was still the case that if you're African American, and in the 70s and even in the 80s, you were not going to be making as much money as a white person in the same job. So what I said, the cynicism that I found among these athletes, professional athletes, about these issues broken down by race, had to do with the history of inequality in America. And so that was that study, and I've been trying like crazy to do it again, right? I've been trying. I went down to Washington with my wife on a little vacation, and I drove her crazy. I said, I'm going to go over to the NFLP. I'm walking right in there. I'm going to talk to this, what's his name, the new guy at the NFLP.
Mark Smith.
What's it again?
Demar Smith.
Yeah. D. Smith, right? D. Smith. And I used to walk in there all the time, and it was kind of an informal thing. Today, things are so tough. It's like you're trying to break into prison. Come to the door, security guy. I leave a note. I leave a copy of my questionnaire. I called D. Smith's office. I called his assistant for a whole year, maybe even 2 years. Honest to God, I'm persistent sometimes. I still want to do that study today, and I want to ask some of those same questions today. And I think it would be overwhelmingly in favor of extending the scholarship, at least to the full cost of education, if not simply saying that these athletes should be allowed to engage in the same entrepreneurial and business activities as their celebrity coaches. I see no reason why they should not be able to.
That's good stuff. We're with Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. I know, Eric, I know you have a question for Dr. Sack. I'll let you ask the question here.
Yeah, Dr. Sack, I did have a chance to take a look at some of your interviews that you've done, and one in particular you state that that it's intellectually dishonest to call collegiate athletes amateurs, and you talk about a reform is needed. So my question to you is, can you discuss your reform plan and what will it really take to make that reform plan a reality?
Well, I go in two directions on this, and I've been caught in this bind for many years, for maybe even decades. When I go onto a talk show, the first question I often get is, should college athletes be paid? All right, that one drives me nuts because it's a leading question, because it presupposes that they're not already paid. And let me try that one again. They say, should college athletes be paid? As soon as I say, yeah, they should be, oh, man, you're attacking amateurs. What's the matter with you? You know, and you're some kind of a deviant. Because you can't win by answering that question. So my response is usually, wait a minute, hold it. Let's reframe that question. The college athletes, as we all know, are already being paid. They're being paid room, board, tuition, and fees. That can amount to as much as $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And that disappears when you walk off the field and say, I'm not playing anymore. That disappears when the coach decides that you're not playing well enough. That's employment. That is pay. That is objectively pay. And I will die arguing that point, even with some of my best friends who argue with me about this. So we're talking about this payment issue and how to change it. All right, so that's one part of me says they should be paid now. Another part of me says, you know, I wish they had never really given athletic scholarships to begin with and maybe stuck with need-based financial aid for everybody. Need-based financial aid for everybody. And this will complicate things a bit, but Walter Byers, the former executive director of the NCAA, had a proposal back in 1995 when he finally discovered the truth after many years of not thinking this. He changed and he wrote a very critical book of the NCAA, which he had been the leader of for decades. And he was arguing that you should have need-based, think about this one, give need-based financial aid to all athletes, that is, based on your family background and how much they can contribute. But allow them to make as much money as they want on the side from different kinds of sponsorship deals or speaking engagements or whatever other their coaches are doing. Then, if these are the good athletes would be the ones who would get this, they could keep that money, and the university is not paying them. It's the outside interests that are paying them, just like they're paying the coach. And it has no consequence whatsoever for Title IX because you're not taking money from the university, and the women are still getting their share of the revenue. And so Walter Byers suggested, let them get the money that way. And this is really genius, he says. And when they finally make so much money that it's as much as they're getting in need-based aid, you cut off their need-based aid because the guys are paying for their own educations by, you know, working outside. Well, that's what Walter Byers is, one of his suggestions, which I thought was kind of unique. My feeling is right now, in all honesty, I don't believe that, and I have a friend, Ramogi Huma, who probably disagrees with me on this one, but I don't think the universities right now have enough money to pay salaries to the big-time college athletes. The money that comes in on the backs of these big-time college athletes in football and basketball right now within an athletic department is spread around to the non-revenue-producing sports and to the women's sports and so forth. So when you get done doing that, there are very few, and this is corroborated by tons of data, very few big-time college athletic programs in the football bowl subdivision are actually making a profit after the money from football and basketball are spread around. All right, so there's really not money there for salaries in the end. But there's no reason why the athletes could not go out and do like in the Olympic model, and that is be able to make money on the side. I believe that they should be able to do that, and they should be able to go to court to say that it's an antitrust violation for them not to be able to do that. So that's one side of me in terms of saying how you could compensate the athletes in a fair and equitable way. And immorally, there's nothing unethical or immoral about that because you are not violating amateurism because they're not amateurs to begin with. And the other direction to go is to maybe go back to where the NCAA is trying to go right now. You know, say, all right, let's back away from the one-year renewable scholarship. In part, maybe these new guys in the NCAA, who's the new president, the new president of the NCAA, man, blank on his name, Emmert or something, I guess. He's trying to move. Honest to God, I was just before the Penn State crisis, I was totally blown away that the NCAA was actually offering and suggesting that they go back to multi-year scholarships so that you could get your four-year scholarships, just like I got at Notre Dame. That really caught my attention, and I was thinking, my God, although many people saw that as a small, maybe symbolic, and maybe just not very significant change. I saw it as radical. They were suggesting, let's go back a bit. Let's go back to where we were when Alan Sack was playing football at Notre Dame, where we had four-year scholarships. So part of me thinks that might be a good way to go, too, so I'm caught in the middle. But if they don't make any change right now, the athletes are going to organize, and the athletes are going to get the court, and they're going to win one of these court cases, and they're going to get paid, and they're going to become employees. And there will be no line of demarcation between professional and college sports. There's very little right now, and whatever little bit there is almost gone. And they'll be the same product. And I don't think I would want that, to tell you the truth, but that's the reality.
Well, Dr. Sack, you really hit a good point there. You have some folks like Ed O'Bannon, who is challenging because NCAA continues to use his likeness and other athletes' likeness as a way of generating revenue. Along with O'Bannon and some of the other, what are some of the movements that are coming about from athletes that you can share with our listeners?
Well, the O'Bannon case is a landmark case. Sonny Vaccaro is heavily involved there, and Sonny, he's a friend. He is really passionate about this. He was the person who started basketball leagues for Nike, if you remember that name, but he is very much in the back of the players on this, and Oscar Robinson signed on to it as a friend of that lawsuit. And O'Bannon, believe it or not, you guys correct me on the facts on this, but my rough idea is here's that O'Bannon who played for UCLA, did he?
Yeah, he played for UCLA, dominant player in their national championship team. Phil, I'll let you fill in on that one.
And then he went off on the NBA, right? Yeah, he was.
Played with New Jersey for a little bit.
So he had a distinguished career, and now he, I don't know if he may be in his 50s. Is that possible, or 40s?
It's probably, I would say he's in his late 30s, early 40s.
All right. Yeah. So he's in this. So he has kids. He walks into a toy store, and they're selling games that he's in those games. You know? And who's getting the licensing fees from that? The NCAA is getting the licensing fees from that, but it's his image and it's him who's in that game, and he has to go and buy it himself, and he doesn't get a cut of that. I have not met, and I'm being honest with you. I've argued with a lot of people, and I've seen it's I've always been seen as kind of radical on these things. But even with this issue, I haven't met any person yet who disagreed when I said, don't you think those athletes who is making all that money through those games and through those licensing agreements, don't you think when they get out of college, they should be getting a cut of the money that they are being generated by the use of their images and by the use of their names and numbers and so on and so forth? To the person, they say, that is outrageous. Those athletes certainly do. Now, people will disagree if I said that while they're still in college, they should be getting a cut of that revenue. I think they should, but most people would say, no, not when they're in college because they're amateurs. That's really crazy, this notion of amateurism. By the way, let me, before you guys kick me off the air, which you probably should at some point, but yeah. I have to mention on this NCAA amateurism thing, in 1906, when the NCAA was founded, they made it perfectly clear, and you can find it in the first NCAA meeting minutes and the manual that they had then, back in 1906, and I have it in my own notes here somewhere. It says clearly that any financial inducement that is used to recruit an athlete, any inducements whatsoever, make a kid not an amateur anymore. All right. Whether that's given from someone outside the university or whether it's given inside the university or whether it's given by the financial aid office, it does not matter. If you give an inducement to a player who's in high school or in a prep school to come to your school because of athletics, you are no longer an amateur. So that's the NCAA's original notion of amateurism and their original definition of amateur, and it still exists if you look at the NCAA manual. Amateurism is an avocation, meaning, look it up in Webster's Dictionary, it says it is a diversion. Did you watch those guys last night playing that game? Are they engaged in a diversion? Is this just something they do in their spare time because they think it's kind of a kick and it's a way to get a little bit of leisure activity during an extracurricular activity? That is absurd. And I even talked to Miles Brand, the former president of the NCAA. He agreed with me on the phone anyway. You know, he couldn't say it openly, but he did agree. He said, yeah, it's about time we should scrap this concept of amateurism. So that is another basis of my book, that really it's intellectually dishonest to call young men and women who are out there on one-year athletic scholarships especially and whose lives are being controlled like this and who are now skilled specialists who are really specializing in mass commercial entertainment to generate millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars actually, for the universities. To call them amateurs is really absurd, and it is, I find it, intellectually dishonest, and I find it immoral to do so. They should, whatever they do, they should scrap that term amateur and come up with a collegiate model or whatever you want to call it, but it's not amateurism in any sense.
Well, before we let you go, I know you were looking to hang with us for a little bit and connect with us. We would like to know a little bit about the Drake Group that you co-founded and to give us a little sense of what that's all about. So folks who are listening might want to go and see what you're doing as part of the Drake Group. But can you explain a little bit about the mission of the Drake Group and what that's all about?
Yeah, this comes to bear on my split personality on these issues, which I kind of talked about as we went along, that I go in two ways on this thing. By joining the Drake Group, I would have to voluntarily, and by being the president, which I will become this spring, I will have to put aside my arguments about paying the athletes and my arguments about, increasing the kind of compensation they get. It's still in my head, and I still believe it's true, but what the Drake Group's going to have to focus itself on is at the academic integrity side of things primarily and look at the faculty themselves and say that we have a responsibility to the athletes and to students to ensure that they get an adequate education. And so the real thrust of things here is to lobby for legislation with the NCAA that would really allow the athletes to be an integral part of the student body. We really believe that there should be we believe strongly in four-year scholarships, which were like the one I had when I was at Notre Dame. And we actually started making progress in pushing that direction under this new president until the Penn State thing occurred and kind of just wiped that all away. I would love to see that the athletes in the same counseling centers as non-athletes. I don't think there should be a separation there. I think the athletes, black and white, and big time and small time, should be part of the whole environment of the university. They should be doing things with and being integrated into other extracurricular activities besides sports. Right now, they tend to be isolated on the periphery of academic life and of social life. They hang out together. That's okay, but you don't go to college to do that. You go to college to expand your horizons, to be involved with other people from wide varieties of backgrounds, from Asia, from Latin America, from other parts of the United States, people who are athletes, non-athletes, people who are scientists, people who are involved in literature. You go there to broaden your lives. And so the Drake Group is really, really committed to trying to make it possible for the athletes to play their sport, to love their sport, but not to be overwhelmed by it to the point that the education becomes like a distraction and maybe just a point of annoyance. Sometimes the athletes say, this is just something I have to do to get through because I want to play pro ball. We'd like to see that change in some way because we truly believe at the bottom and from a racial point of view, coming in with regard to black athletes who are at the very center of this, is that I believe with, along with my friend Alan Page and with, my God, the famous tennis player, who was this very famous black, Arthur Ashe.
Arthur Ashe.
Yeah, Arthur Ashe took the position, I believe, 100%. He said that sports has played enough of a role. This is controversial, maybe even with you black guys who are on your show, but that sports has played an incredible role in the life of African Americans, and it's been very positive in certain ways. But perhaps now it's getting to a negative point where a young 8-year-old is thinking about the future, but thinks of that future and being like Michael Jordan, rather than being like Obama. And I would prefer, and our group would really prefer, that these young black kids identify and try to be the president of the United States rather than being the star in the NBA. And the reason for that is because if you try to be a star in the NBA, you develop certain very specialized skills which are not necessarily generalizable to other areas of life that you need to really survive and prosper in a global economy. Now, you may not get to be Michael Jordan, and most likely you're not going to. And what do you have? You got a lot of athletic skills. Wonderful, but they're not very transferable to the technological and other demands of our society. Spend your time as a young black kid trying to be Obama. You're probably not going to become president, but damn it, along the way, trying to be Obama, you're going to learn how to read, you're going to learn about history, you're going to learn about political science, you're going to take courses in a wide variety of ways, introducing you to technology and all the things that you need to be a competent administrator and a manager and a president. And you don't get to be the president? Fine, but you have this solid education. And I dream about a world where blacks will not be overrepresented on the athletic teams, where I won't sit down and watch a basketball game or a football game like I did last night and see this predominance of black athletes out there. Those guys are smart. Those guys they have to be smart. You can't play football today and be dumb. You cannot. But they're not as broadly educated as I think they should be because they've gotten into this real rat race of I want to be a professional athlete. And forgive me if I make people mad with that one, but I believe that we're not asking enough of the universities to broaden the educational experiences of African Americans so they can all be Obamas. And that would be my
question. Well, I will say that as someone who works with college athletes, have met with parents, when I open up my talk, I often ask them, if they know that Shaquille O'Neal has an MBA and he's working on a doctorate as a way of shifting and understanding what the possibilities are. And so the point that you're making about the Drake Group, we'd love to have you come back
and talk about it, because that's in the heart of what we – how do we have more Alan Pages of the world? How do we have more Myron Rolls, who is a Rolls Scholar? How do we have more of those student stories being more of the narrative of college sports, as well as the Honey Badger? So we have Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. It's been great to have you on the show. We're going to segment into a funky editorial, but we'd love to have you on the show. I know you want to talk about Penn State, and we will talk about a funky editorial if you can stick with us,
sure.
If that works for you in your schedule. But we'll be moving into our the funky editorial brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions. Here we go.
Fellas, only one thing we need to say. Can we say it, y'all? Melvin, Jimmy, Coleman, Ryan, say it. Everybody want to get funky one more time.
Well, our funky editorial for today is about the Penn State hire of Jim O'Brien and the reaction from the alumni, particularly the former players who are, I believe, a part of the Letter Club, who had a really weird response to him. And one of the things we want to talk about is whether or not they're justified in their response, particularly about, you know, when we see what recently happened at Michigan with Rich Rodriguez in terms of we need a Michigan man, we need a Penn State man, what is that all about in terms of that? And so that's going to be a topic of our funky editorial. I'll toss it out there. Maybe we'll start with Phil to kind of have a little reaction to this, and then we'd love to go to Dr. Sack real quick to have his reaction to Penn State. So, Phil, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think this is very interesting because – like you mentioned, there's been a huge backlash from the Penn State family for not selecting a quote-unquote Penn State guy. And I'm not surprised by this, okay? You know, the players, the current student-athletes there, they wanted the guy, I can't think of his name, the guy that stepped in and was the interim coach, you know, to get the full-time job. But I think from a perception management standpoint, Penn State had to separate themselves from Sandusky, which means they had to separate themselves from Paterno. And hiring any Penn State man or guy, 99 times out of 100, they're going to have a strong allegiance and a connection with Paterno. So I think from a perception management standpoint, I agree with Penn State going outside of the Penn State family to bring in O'Brien. I'm not so sure that he's the right guy, but quite honestly, I think the pool that they had to select from was going to be very thin because nobody wants to be the guy after the guy in terms of being paternal and following
that's right.
up.
That's right. Dr. Sack, have you had a chance to follow this story, and what do you think about the Penn State hire and the reaction of folks at Penn State? I know you spent some time with folks on that campus before.
Yeah. Who was that to just respond? Is that you, Eric, or who was it?
Phil.
Phil, that was I can't say it any better. I think from a political point of view, and just in terms of what if you're at Penn State and you're in administration, you would like to show that you talk about Notre Dame, they call it Fortress Notre Dame, meaning Fortress Notre Dame, but you don't penetrate that damn thing, and nobody knows anything that's going on inside Notre Dame from a public relations point of view. And that's the kind of thing that leads to a scandal like the Penn State one. So maybe Penn State saying, hey, look, we don't want to look like Fortress Penn State, especially now when they're under such scrutiny, and they want to show we're open to the open world. We're going to open ourselves up, and you can take a look in. So staying parochial and inside suggests, hey, we're going to associate ourselves too much with the former administration, the Joe Paterno group for all those years. It's time for a refreshing wind coming in from the outside. I think, is it Jim O'Brien? Is that his name?
Jim O'Brien.
Jim O'Brien from the Patriots. I read some stuff today where the quarterbacks out there are thinking this is pretty cool, you know, to be able to be coached by someone who's such a fine offensive coordinator for the New England Patriots. I think he'll win them over. He sounds to me like he's going to have a a charismatic kind of personality. I think the athletes did meet with him, and generally there was now a more positive reaction. But of course, that's irrelevant if he loses. It's a Charlie Weiss situation, you know. So whether he can win or not, that's another question.
Well, and I think one of the key things about, particularly with the Rich Rodriguez situation, that it wasn't just going away from a Michigan man, but they also went away from a Michigan style of play. They revamped the type of program, and they went into something that's different. I don't see this hire. It may be going away from a Penn State guy, but I don't know if it's going away from a Penn State philosophy in terms of how they play the game of football. And I think that's the one that I don't want. I hope people don't get, I guess, to kind of follow in terms of making the comparison with Rich Rodriguez. You went from a totally – with that hire, they threw the baby out with the bathwater. They threw everything out of it in terms of Michigan style and play that they're rebuilding right now. Penn State, I don't see that as what they're actually doing.
I don't see that either, and I think they took that into consideration when they were making the hire. You're not going to a totally different kind of offense just switching the whole philosophy. So I'm cautiously optimistic here that I think Penn State can make a real quick turnaround and just hang in there and continue being a winner. I'm very concerned, and I hate to pull this thing back to previous issues we've been talking about, but I'm very concerned that we're going to forget about what happened at Penn State. We're going to forget that this was not simply a deviant act by a pedophile, and that could happen anywhere. This was a cover-up of a deviant act by a pedophile, by not only the coaching staff, but by the entire university, so that I perceive this thing as a national problem of big-time college sports taking over and actually intimidating the hell out of the university governance structure rather than an egregious act, which is a isolated thing that took place in a locker room with sodomizing a young 10-year-old. So I just did want to make that point, that it's easy for us all to immediately go back to talking football and talking sports and are they going to win, blah, 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 and forgetting what happened there. And what happened there was not simply a deviant act. This is endemic to big-time college sports, that people on college campuses live in fear of allowing something negative to get out about their college football program or their athletic programs, so much so that they'll throw their academic values and standards and commitments and ethics under the bus in order to placate and in order to protect our athletic programs. That's the story I see coming out of Penn State, and it's not just a Penn State story. It's a big-time college sports story, and I hope that doesn't get lost as we go back. And I'm not criticizing the discussion we're having right now, because I love to talk about, is Penn State going to be able to come back from this? What kind of coach should they have? Are they going to win? That's an important issue. But that backdrop, you know, that I think we shouldn't forget about.
And I think in the way in which you laid that out is really a part of how we attack the funky editorial. We try to get that story behind the story, because that's something that we've been talking about, is who's in charge? And we know who's in charge. And how does that change even with this? Does that change? Are we masking it? And I think that is really the story, as you said, behind the story. And is that something that's going to still be in the forefront? And part of this hire was get us as far away from that as possible so that we can get back to the business of sports.
Right? Yeah, and do any of you guys truly believe that there were not people on the Board of Governors and the Board of Trustees that knew about this at Penn State?
Oh, no. nothing happens without folks way up. Nothing happens without the folks at that level knowing about it.
Exactly.
We cannot be fooled. So I think
if we can get
the
attention of the public away from that and get back onto sports and get – well, they did it. They went and played a game right after, you know, at the time. Instead of taking a game off and kind of having some soul-searching, then went right back to playing football. And I think that's what's going to happen here. Everybody's going to go back to playing football. And if that happens, we go back to the same problems that we have at the larger level.
Well, I think you're right on. And, Dr. Stack, we want to definitely thank you for contributing to our funky editorial. We hope that you will come back to our show because I think we just hit the tip of the iceberg. And so hopefully we can extend an invitation to you as well.
Please feel free to stay on as long as possible, but I know you have a busy schedule. We definitely would love to have you come back.
Yeah, I'm going to have to run along, but I want to tell you guys that I've done hundreds, literally hundreds of interviews, and I've never had a interviewer who are as well prepared as you guys are. You've got a great show going there, so terrific. Thank you for having me. I feel privileged to have been on your show, to tell you the truth.
Well, thank you, and we will definitely have you back, and have a great evening.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Well, we had that was Dr. Alan Sack. He fit right into RSG. We had a great time. He's right up in there. I love his attitude. And Eric, we want to give you a chance to even comment on this funky editorial as well. Hit us with how you feel about Penn State. But I'm just excited right now. I thought that was a great segment. But, Eric, come in and give us your two cents on Penn State.
I thought it was a phenomenal discussion. Phil, you hit everything right on the head. Just one other piece that we may not have discussed is the difference, you know, me being a Michigan guy, the difference between the Rodriguez move as opposed to this Penn State move is Michigan voluntarily went and got Rodriguez, a non-Michigan guy, knowing that he would change the schematics of what Michigan is about. Penn
That's
State
right.
didn't have a choice. This is something that they had to do. In order to get away from everything paternal, they had to make a move away from a Penn State guy. So that was my only two cents I wanted to bring in on that.
That you hit it right on the head, and we're going to continue to monitor this story. That was our Resistance Digital Solutions, the funky editorial for us. Great topic to go on. We're going to move into five on the black-hand side to hit that. So we're at five on the black-hand side. I think we missed our little cue on that one that we usually have on that. But our five on the black-hand side that is going on is looking at NFL Honors Award Show. Is that a good idea, bad idea? Talk a little bit about that, gentlemen. Who wants to take that?
I'll jump in. This is Eric. You know what? I think it's a good idea. When I initially heard it, I thought it was crazy, you know. But, you know, I think overall we have to look at that the NFL All-Star Game, you know, the Pro Bowl, you know, it's one of the only majors, actually the only major All-Star Game that draws lower ratings than the regular season games. And something needed to be done. So moving the Pro Bowl to, you know, that week between the Super Bowl and adding more flair to it, I think, is a benefit. Ratings were up 8% from the year before, you know, for last year. So I think it's a good idea. Continue to draw attention to it. Continue to bring the red carpet out. More viewers will follow. The ratings will increase.
So if you were to think about, you know, our number two is if you were to think about an all-star event, what's the best all-star event that we have going on? If you think about baseball, basketball, or football, what's your best kind of league all-star event? For you,
Yeah, I think football, NFL, is probably ranks three, you know, even probably behind the NHL. I mean, the Pro Bowl in Honolulu just never was something priority. It was in the off season. You know, now it's a little bit more relevant, but still, the for me, the NBA All-Star Game, that weekend is an event. And it's not just that game, but it's the NBA All-Star persona that goes along with that weekend. I mean, it's sold out. They're doing comedy shows. They're doing about everything. That whole weekend is just a festival of times, and I did attend one of those. I mean, it's a phenomenal event.
I tell you. I went to the one. They had one up in Minnesota. It is the most incredible. Nobody, if you have a choice, go to NBA All-Star Weekend. You didn't have to go to the game. Everybody,
yeah.
Somebody, is there that weekend, the events they have, the alumni in terms of them sponsoring events, when you think about some of the ex-NBA players and their involvement. NBA does a really good job of honoring the history of just involving so many folks in it. It's almost like a homecoming for the athletes. They come back for it. But just, that, you know, we're talking about intersection between entertainment, sports, who's who. NBA weekend, there's nothing like it, All-Star Weekend.
Agreed, hands down.
Can't do it. When I think about baseball, baseball's trying to do something. I mean, they try to make, you know, some adjustments in terms of trying to add some value into the baseball experience with tying it to the World Series, which I'm still not sure if that's the right call or not. But I think baseball is trying to work on it. What's your opinion on that?
Well, you know, along with that, I think the All-Star game is nice for baseball. It brings in a nice crowd, nice draw, and, you know, they do the home run derby. So there's festivities that go along with that. I think that's pretty popular. But for me, it's got to be that NBA weekend. As you mentioned, that whole aura that goes around it, even if you don't go to the All-Star game, it's that whole weekend is just filled with a lot of events to do, a lot of stuff to do. And I've never personally attended an All-Star game for baseball, so can't speak on that.
Okay. When we think about the Rookie of the Year awards, who's your Rookie of the Year, Harris?
I don't even think this should even be an argument.
I thought you said Debo.
Oh, no, we're talking about Rookie of the Year, right?
Yeah, so Rookie of the Year. Oh, no, Rookie of the Year. We are talking about Rookie. Tebow is treated like a rookie anyway.
They sure are. I'm going Cam Newton. And I don't even think it's much to be said. This guy, what he did in his rookie year, he's in a 4,000-yard club, 60% completion, 422 yards, 2 touchdowns.
Say
he broke a lot of Peyton Manning's records.
Say
this guy is a flat-out beast. I mean, he led the NFL in rushing touchdowns for a quarterback with 13. He holds several NFL records. I'm not talking about rookie records.
Can you dig it?
Absolutely. This guy holds NFL records.
I just had to give you a can you dig it.
This dude is a monster, man. I can't even front. This is my guy. This shouldn't even be a contest. You can't say Dalton. I don't even want to make a case for Dalton. What Cam has done, he's got NFL records.
This is the funny thing. I wish Game Changer was in the house because all last year, we're going to have to put together a segment. I have to put Phil T on it because you know he's just precise. He can do this. But we need to go back and listen to all the old tape. When we were having these arguments about Cam Newton, and I was on my own. I mean, they were coming at me. I'm looking at the tape, and I'm saying, at Auburn, I'm saying, he looked like a quarterback who could play. Why y'all seeing what I'm not? I mean, I'm seeing that he looked like he can play. There's nothing about his delivery. There's nothing about the way he can make all the throws.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came in and just did his thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did his thing. So you say Cam Newton. I'm with you on Cam. I cannot even front on it. I think he's just blown the hinges off the door. If you think about what this young man has been gone through, you can say it's self-inflicted. You can say whatever you want to say about his experience at Auburn. But I watched him and I learned something from the way he handled. Most people would have crumbled under that pressure. He just got better.
Yeah.
And to me, that mental toughness, which is what you need. And the thing about it is, you have to add in the fact that he didn't have all the mini camps.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have all the other stuff. So when they start to compare him historically, you have to put it in the context of that he didn't really have all the lead-ins to even get ready. He had a short preparation for NFL, and he still balled.
Mm-hmm.
That is what's incredible. We got Phil T back in the building with us. We talk about Rookie of the Year. Who's your Rookie of the Year?
Cam Newton. probably for the same reasons that you guys just said when I was off the air. But quite honestly, I think when you look at the Panthers, they earned the first pick of the draft last year. Okay. They were 2-14. They've improved to 6-10, which, you know, from a distance, you might say, okay, 6-10, why is that exciting? Why is that Rookie of the Year worthy. That four-game improvement is noteworthy, especially considering the division they're in. I mean, they have two other playoff teams within that division, and those four games against the Saints and the Falcons, they were competitive games. You know, you think about what he did against the Packers. Of the 10 games they lost, they were right in them, you know, in seven of those games. They were right in it to the last possession. So for those reasons, I think running the ball, passing the ball, and take a step back. Cam Newton right now is what we want Tebow to become. If Tim Tebow grows to the quarterback that Cam Newton is right now, he would defy, you know, 99% of the haters that don't think Tebow can be any more than what he is right now. Okay?
That's right.
So for that reason, and Andy Dalton had a solid year. A.J. Green had a solid year. But I'm going Cam Newton, both hands in.
So it's been a can of sweet. And what I was saying was we got to play the tape. I need you to go, Phil, you have that. You know, you're in that research mode.
Yeah.
We need to start pulling the old tape. We need to put together kind of a montage or whatever of all our Cam Newton discussions. Because I remember early on, I mean, Game Changer was killing me.
Yeah,
I was killing
me. And I'll give you your due. I will give you your due in terms of you told us so, we laughed at you, you gave reasons why you told us so, you laughed at us. I mean, we laughed at you. And to the other side, I'll give credit to Eric. Because in our fantasy football league, Eric snatched him up quick. And that's probably one of the biggest reasons why Eric won the championship this year.
Well, see, smart guys think alike. Eric and I, we on that same wavelength. See, that's why we can get down like this. You know, it must be the you know, we all got the Michigan roots, but we ain't got the same roots. It's something about that we understand it. So I'm gonna leave the camp thing alone, but I definitely will revisit it when Game Changer comes back into the building. MVP, Breeze, Rodgers, or do you have another person you think is MVP? Phil T, we'll go to you.
I'm going with Aaron Rodgers for a couple of reasons. Team's 15-1. The stat that sticks out to me that just screams MVP is his touchdown-interception ratio. He's thrown 45 touchdowns to only 6 interceptions. That's
wow.
A 7+1 ratio, a 7-1 ratio. Okay, when we talk about in basketball, if a good point guards have 2-1, 3-1 assist to turnover ratio. Quarterbacks, you're looking for a 2-1, possibly a 3-1 ratio in terms of interceptions. When you look at how much he throws with the limited running game and the limited commitment that they've made to the running game, and he's only thrown 6 interceptions. That's it for me, hands down. He's an MVP.
That's it. Eric, who do you want?
You know, I think that that Aaron Field makes some awesome points, and Aaron Rodgers is the easy one to pick. But I'm going to go in a little bit of a different direction with Drew Brees. And the reason I'm going with Brees is he leads Rodgers in every category except the one Field threw out, which is the touchdowns to interceptions. He's leading them in completion percentage, yards by over 800, and touchdowns. He has less sacks that could be from his maneuvering. And the other thing that kind of caught me, and Phil, I know you witnessed it as well. Game 17, when the backup quarterback stepped in to play for Aaron Rodgers, this guy threw for 500-plus yards and 6 touchdowns, a Lambeau record. So what that means, I'm not taking anything from Aaron Rodgers because the guy is flat-out bald. But does it have something to do with the system for a man to step in, a backup quarterback that, Phil, you probably don't even know where this dude play. I know I don't. You might. But I have no idea who this guy is. He stepped in the mix. It was some snow coming down. Poised, getting it done, receivers in the right places, ball falling into their arms. 6 touchdowns, a Lambeau record. It was cold. So, again, I mean, I'm not taking anything away from Aaron Rodgers, but I am at the same time. I'm going to lean toward Brees on this one.
I want winners.
That's what I was going to say, is I want winners. Thank you for hitting that, because I was just about to click that. And this is what I can say about that. You said it was cold, and it was what, against Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this, that was part of it. Yeah, this indoor TV playing outside, but Aaron Rodgers is doing it. I think Brees has an advantage this year that Aaron doesn't have is that Brees has a dominant running game. He has a good running game. And Brees has been doing this with injuries, no real running game, no consistent attack on the run. He's been doing a lot of different looks. He's got a defense, which you can argue that the offense contributes to the defense of ranking, but the defense was ranked, last in the league. So he's not getting they're not getting the necessary turnovers that they were getting last year, yet he was still finding a way to win. And so from that, I know Flynn had the great performance, and I was one. I tweeted on it. I hit it up on Facebook, what does it say? But Rodgers makes all the throws. He does everything you need him to do. And I would say 15-1, he's the MVP. That's what it means. So in terms of trying to put this together, I see we got my man from Hallmark, Skimmy, and Mo, who was on us the other day. Mo Red, you're in the building. Talk to us, man. How you doing tonight?
Oh, man, just talking with the real sports guys. What could be better? Just want to give a shout-out to you guys tonight for a great show. I was listening to you guys talking with Dr. Alan Sack earlier and some good stuff on there, just amazing insights. And just I got to go out and get that book. I want to hear some more about what he's got going on. And some of the stuff he's done has been really amazing in terms of the research and out there. Just, send mailers out to the pro players. These guys, it's pretty amazing. So I just want to give you guys a shout-out for some good stuff out there, as always, and, going above and beyond and getting somebody like that on your show tonight was some good stuff. So just thought I'd give a quick call in before the show went out to kind of let you know I was about to listen to you guys and some good stuff to listen to and to give us a little bit of food for thought.
Well, hey, Mo, thank you for always supporting. Thank you for sitting in on the show when we need you. We're definitely going to be doing more with you as we move forward in this. And we definitely appreciate it. You know, what we're trying to do, our theme for the year is we're raising the bar. We try to do what Saban think he's doing. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to go back-to-back. We're trying to win championships. We're trying to put this together, but we're trying to do it the right way. We're trying to be the true scholar athlete.
I want winners.
That's it. Winners who understand it. I'm trying to do it in the spirit of Alan Page. In the spirit of Lou Alcindor, that is what we're trying to bring to the game, both intellectual, but then we can still dominate Dunker. We will slap it off the glass. Don't get it twisted. So thank you for putting that in. Who's your MVP this year while you're with us? Give us that.
MVP for the year?
NFL
MVP, I think I touched on a little bit last week, is I got to go with Rodgers. I know you guys are kind of debating about it back and forth a little bit, but 15-1, and this year with the Green Bay defense really not showing up very much this year. You know, a lot of shootouts that Green Bay had to kind of fight their way out. You know, Rodgers has got to be is the hands down choice. You know, Brees had a great year as well, but he's got 40 plus touchdowns, and what he's got like six interceptions, something like that. So I mean, you got to look at 15-1. That he was definitely the reason why, especially that they were able to do the things they did. And like I said, a lot of guys on defense didn't really step up as they did last year. So I got to give it to Rodgers.
You know, Mo, you bring up some good points, and Eric, your Drew Brees nomination is a good one. Okay, you're certainly in a minority right now. Okay, but it's a good one. And see, this is the issue that I have with the MVP award. Same thing happened in baseball. Matt Kemp, the center fielder for the Dodgers, he didn't win the MVP. Why? Well, because his team was nowhere in playoff contention. The MVP and this is across sports. I mean, you look at Derrick Rose winning last year. Oftentimes, it's about whose team did the best. You know, my biggest reason, oh, Rodgers, his team went 15-1. Well, does that really mean that he's the MVP? Does it really mean Derrick Rose deserved the MVP last year over LeBron James? You know, did it really mean that Matt Kemp shouldn't have won it in baseball? You know, and that's just the issue that I have with the MVP. Perhaps we should call it something else. MVP on the best team.
Well, I mean, I would say that some of that's true, and I think my case for Rodgers, because, I mean, we talk about the play of Flynn, and yeah, that was a great game, but it's not – I don't see that was a sustainable play. What I look at is that Rodgers, under his leadership, even an MVP finish year, but he had losses last year. And with a defense that is ranked, what, 32nd? And so if their defense had played, I think, more dominantly like they did in the playoffs this year, that might have hurt him as much with his MVP voting, with, at least with me. But given the fact that he isn't getting a lot of help, and I think some of that can be attributed to the fact that they score a lot, and so their defense statistics might be warped a little bit. But for me, I think that in this case, that I, with Rodgers, with Drew Brees as a very close second, I'm not saying. I think the part that doesn't give Brees that much from the offensive side is that his running game is much more dominant than Rodgers. Much more dominant than Rodgers. And having that type of balance allows for him to shine even more in a way that everybody knows that Rodgers got to throw. But they don't really have that much of a dominant running game. So that would be my way in which I justify my support for Rodgers as MVP.
Okay, let me ask this question, okay, because this has been thrown out as well. MVP in some scenarios was, if you pull this player off of this team, who has the most impact, okay? Now, again, I think Aaron Rodgers is phenomenal. He makes throws that I haven't seen made before. He's so accurate and pinpoint. That back shoulder to my fellow Kalamazoo Central alum, Greg Jennings, is just remarkable. However, we've seen Aaron Rodgers out a full game, what, in 2 years? So I think the last 2 years he started every game for the most part. I think he might have had an injury last year against the Lions or something like that. But nevertheless, so this guy was out a full game. His backup quarterback, Matt Flynn, stepped in and put up those ridiculous numbers, 6 touchdowns, 500 and something. If Drew Brees went down, is there – I don't care who the backup is. It could be, I don't know, some cold backup. But can they step in – and control and command this offense like Brees can? Similar to what he does is very similar to what Manning was doing out in Indy. And that's why when Manning got injured, Indianapolis offense just fell apart because nobody could command it like he could.
But I would argue that over a sustained period of time, New Orleans has more options and weapons because they have the depth at the running game, that over time, yeah, he had that record-setting throw, but I don't think that would have been sustained over time. Versus New Orleans having the running game, having other weapons offensively, along with a defense that plays much better right now than Green Bay defense, or at least one step better, 31 versus 32, but playing a little bit better. But I think the addition of the running game, and we don't know, it's more hypothetical, but I think when you got a running game, you got more things to go to. Look at Indy, they had no running game.
They had no quarterback.
Huh?
I said, maybe MVP then.
Yeah, Mandy. I was about to give it to Mandy.
He likes to vote.
Respect that. I think this is a great topic. We're going to come back to this after we see a little bit more of the playoff run a little bit and kind of do it. We're going to go into our off-the-dome topics and try to just get a little focus in on this as we start to look at why we're talking about quarterbacks. Of the QBs, the best QBs remaining in the playoffs, how would you rank them? in terms of Rodgers, Brees, Brady, Manning, Alex Smith, Flacco, Tebow, Yates. How do you rank them in terms of the best quarterback left in the playoffs? Eric, you got a roll going, so let me you rank them real quick.
I'm starting off with Brady because he's got the most hardware in his clutch. I got Brees at number two. Rodgers is playing phenomenally well, but I think Brees has done it a little longer. I got Rodgers at three. Then I'm going with inconsistent Eli. I'll put Tebow ahead of Flacco, followed by Alex Smith and T.J. Yates.
Okay. That's a good ranking. Phil T.
You know, my list looks pretty much like Eric's, and pretty much for the same reasons. I've got Smith ahead of Yates for the seventh and eighth, but, you know, who cares when you get down that low, you're in trouble. If those are the guys you're trying to lead the two-minute drill and you're down by six. I put Brady in the head of the class because he's done it the most in clutch situations. For some reason, I love Aaron Rodgers, but, man, you got to do it for a couple of years before I put you ahead of Brees and Brady and Peyton Manning. And like Eric said, Eli Manning has cost many a man, many a woman, many a fantasy team manager games with his inconsistent play. So
cost them their lunch money.
That's right. That's right. And honestly, I put Tebow ahead of Flacco, and I almost put him ahead of Manning just because he gets it done. I really can't explain how he gets it done. Like Herman Cain says,
I don't have facts to back this up.
But he gets it done. I don't know. So honestly, I was considering putting Tebow at four, right behind Rodgers.
You hit it right on the head. You hit it right on the head. Mo, where would you put this? If you're hearing the kind of rankings, how would you rank the remaining quarterbacks?
Hey, I think I'm going to give you four top ones, so the other four just pretty much, you know, also ran. I'm going to give you my four picks for this week, so they kind of follow from last week. But top four, I got to go with Rodgers. You know, I'm a Bears fan saying that, but Rodgers, you know, obviously winning the hardware last year and, you know, having the highest quarterback rating of all time. You know, I think he's definitely on top of his game right now, in his peak right now. I got to give Brees the second nod. You know, obviously breaking the Dan Marino's record this year, he's on top of his game as well. You know, Brady, you know, is kind of like a slight touch behind, but, you know, still, that pitcher for sure. But, you know, he hasn't been quite as good this year as he has been in previous interceptions and some of those things. And, you know, they lost last year at home in the playoffs to the Jets. So I'm looking to see if they can bounce back this year. Otherwise, it might be – they might have declined a little bit there in New England, so not because the AFC is East is not really been that great. They could be taking a step back here, and then Eli Manning has definitely been having a great year, and you know obviously he's got a ring, but I got him on my fantasy team this year, so yeah, I definitely know he can be Jekyll and Hyde sometimes, so he can be dangerous for you as well. You know he's definitely got some playoff experience. I'm going to get into my picks for this week. You know, had a 2-2 week last week. You know, I missed the Bengals. I did call the Saints to win that game. I thought it'd be a little closer game than it was. Picked the Giants to win against Atlanta. I did not pick Pittsburgh to win the game, but I did think it was gonna be close game. And those points was too much to give for Pittsburgh, getting 8.5 points. So I did pick that correctly in terms of thread there. This week, again, I'm picking against the Vegas line. We've been doing against the Vegas line here for the betting public out there, just in case you might wager on a Sunday, Saturday afternoon. New Orleans is giving away 3.5 points at San Francisco, taking New Orleans plus those points or minus those points. Thinking that New Orleans is going to have a little bit too much firepower for San Francisco, although I think it'll be a much closer game.
Hey, Mo.
Yeah.
Let's move the four picks really quick into the after hour. But
okay.
As we're rolling the show out really quick here, we want to thank Dr. Alan Sack. We want to thank Eric Hamilton for being on the show. We got to thank Mo Phil T engineered this from behind the scenes. Got to give love. We missed the game changer and Ray. This has been live. We're going to go to the four picks in the after hour for you people who are downloading. Get it. This is Real Sports Guys. This is how we do it. It's 2012. We're bringing it in strong. It was a great show. See you in the after hour.
Crazy in there. And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, I'm looking in the mirror. But I look good. I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
We in the after hours, D. Wills.
You got to put a little fiesta there, man. After
hey,
the show, the after
still,
party. Y'all still out there?
Yeah, I'm here.
After hours, I had it on mute. This is how crazy it's been. We're in the after party. We got Phil T, we got Eric, we got Mo in the after at the after party. We got like a, you know, we are drained. This was a great show. Mo was giving us his pick four. Mo hit us with that pick four.
Hey, for that after party, you got to put a little fiesta there. Put a little Jay-Z and R. Kelly in there at the after party. Fiesta.
Can't wait. Can't wait.
All right, yeah, I go real quick here just to get out of there. But yeah, I said New Orleans is at San Francisco. New Orleans giving away 3.5. Taking New Orleans, giving away those points. I said I think New Orleans is going to have too much firepower for them. Looking for a much closer game with New Orleans coming out of the dome, playing on the road. But I don't think San Francisco is going to have the firepower to kind of stay with them. So. New Orleans in that game. New England has given away 13.5 against Denver. Huge number. Everybody's loving Tebow right now. And, you know, I do give him props for actually, you know, winning the game with his arm for a change there. So, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think the dream's going to be over this week. And so I think New England's definitely, they show up. They have a recipe for them last time they played them. And I don't see people putting up that kind of game again, although New England does have the worst-ranked defense, but I don't see Tim Tebow being that precise again. So take New England and giving away the 13.5, which is a huge number, but I think New England is going to show a little something when they get out there to Foxborough. My upset special of the week here. What's that?
So you say Cinderella is... The ball is over for Cinderella.
The ball is over, that's for sure.
It's a pumpkin showing up. He's going to come from Foxborough picking that. It's a glass slipper with a pumpkin. My family don't come into the after hour, too. They always mess with me. You're giggling in the background. They're in the house with me, too. It's a group thing back here. This is how we do it after hours. They're going to want to mess with me. But, yeah, it's about to come to an end from what you're saying about Tebow.
And a little extra little tidbit there. John Elway will be drafting a quarterback in the draft, so just be ready for that. Giants at Green Bay, upset special of the week. Giants are getting 7.5 points. You know, again, another big number there for plus game. Giants played them really tough earlier in the regular season.
know, Green Bay, I think, is a great team, especially playing at home, but Giants are also kind of a cold-weather team. I think the Giants are probably the most well-rounded team that's in the playoffs. You know, if they put their game together, obviously it can be up and down sometimes, but they usually show up for big games. You know, they have the running game going with Bradshaw and Jacobs now, back healthy, and you look at Victor Cruz and what's happening with Nix. I think they got the passing attack. I think Green Bay's defense has obviously been suspect this year. So I think this is ripe for another upset. The Giants pulled it off a couple years ago with Brett Favre's last game. And I think it's going to happen again here. Giants plus the 7.5 at Green Bay. You heard it here first. And then Baltimore is hosting Houston. Texans pulled off you know, their first playoff victory last week. It'll be a much different story this week playing at Baltimore. Yates played okay last week, but it's going to be a much different story with the defense here in Baltimore. And I think it's going to be a little bit too much of Ray Rice going left and right, and Flacco's going to do enough, although Flacco's never really impressed me too much in the playoffs yet. But I've picked Baltimore the last couple years to make that step, and I think this is going to be the year. I think it's going to shape up for them in the right direction. And Baltimore will take out Houston. And even giving away that 7.5 points, Baltimore's going to win that game and put themselves in the championship, AFC championship mode there. So those are my four picks for this week, boys.
All right, Mo from the Hallmark Skimmy Mo Show, thank you for being on. We're going to transition to the other fellas. We got going on, we got the Giants and the Packers. Who you got, Phil T?
I'm going Giants.
You going Giants?
I like the way Yeah, I like the way their defensive line is playing, man. They can get pressure on Rodgers. I mean, the Packers have a timing offense, so they can get that pressure on Rodgers with just their front four. I think they can win.
Okay. All right, Eric, who you got?
Yeah, same thing. I think we all predict an upset here. The Giants are getting healthy at the right time. As long as inconsistent Eli can have a decent game, I think that they'll be perfectly fine for the upset.
I said Giants were the worst team that they didn't want to see him because of that front four. I'm going to go with the Giants as well. I've said that. I thought the Giants were the team that was going to make the run. You know, Buffalo has 9 lives, and I can say that. Saints against the 49ers. We got the Harbaugh playoff era beginning, Jim Harbaugh. Who do you got, Eric?
I am taking the, you said the Saints and 49ers?
Yeah.
I'm taking the Saints. I think the Saints, I think it's going to be a lot closer than people think because it's going to be in Candlestick. It's going to be wet. Grass is going to be long, but I'm taking the Saints.
Okay. What do you got, Phil?
They are who we thought they were.
I'm going with the Saints on the road.
I want to go with the 49ers because, you know, I'm a you know, Harbaugh family connection. But I got to go with the Saints. I think they're beginning to put it all together. And I think it's going to be a close game. I think Breeze is going to score and run out of there. He's going to run out of there. And 49ers are learning how to win. So I'm going to go with the Saints. Denver at the Patriots. Tebow travels to Foxborough. Cinderella is on the plane. Who do you got? We'll go with Phil.
Well, you know, since I need to be the person to pat myself on the back, and like the game changer always says, we're guys who like to be right. I need to point out. I need to point out that I, out of my 6 picks last week, 5 of them were incorrect. Okay.
That's right.
But the one that was correct, and Devon, I know you as a Steeler fan, okay? The one that was correct was I picked Denver over the Steelers, okay? I really want to go with Denver again. And Eric has a very nice philosophy, very interesting philosophy on Tebow. But Belichick just kicked their butt earlier in the season, so I got to go with the Patriots.
Okay. Eric, you have an interesting philosophy on Tebow. Talk about that. Pick this game. Who are you picking?
You know, I think this is going to be an interesting matchup, first of all. I think it's not going to be as much of a blowout as one would think. But, you know, I think, Phil, we kind of joke around a little bit about it, but, you know, I think we all kind of see this aura about Tim Tebow, that it's something special about this guy. It's something non-natural about this guy. I'd like to check his lineage, check his birth certificate to see who his mom and dad really are, if it's Joseph and Mary. But going to New England, I think that it's going to be too much Tom Brady. Jeff McDaniels is back in the house for New England. He's going to provide a little bit of information on Champ Bailey and some tendencies. I'm liking the Patriots in a 14-point margin.
Wow.
Josh McDaniels, too. I think I said Jeff. Josh, excuse me.
You know, that's a good point, Eric, because McDaniels was calling the plays last year in Denver.
Yes.
And he knows what Tebow does well and what he doesn't do well. And if you think about the last couple of games of the season when Tebow was playing, you know, he put up some 280, 300-plus yards a game. So
yeah,
that's an interesting point with McDaniels. I like that.
And I think because of that, and, you know, Patriots have been catching it the last few years. Everybody, you know, they've lost with their last three playoff games. And so they're at a point where people are questioning them. And so I think they prove their point. They win. Belichick likes to put something through your heart. He's probably tired of hearing about this kid. He's going to figure something out. You're like, you're not going to make a fool out of me. He's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go with the Patriots. The Texans and the Ravens, my boy John Harbaugh. That's my guy. What's going on? But I don't know if I'm going to pick him. But, hey, Phil, who are you going with, the Texans and the Ravens?
We need more dogs.
Ravens have the dogs. Their defense, you know, as long as Ray Lewis is playing, I'm taking the Ravens over the Texans.
All right, Eric.
As long as the offensive coordinator doesn't try to turn this into a shootout, and he gives Ray Rice the ball. Give this man the ball. Don't try to have Flacco throwing the ball 40, 50 times a game. Ravens win all day. But Ray needs that ball.
This is going to be probably one of the better games of the weekend. I think this is going to be, and I think the Phillips factor in Texas, there's certain coaches that are just great at being coordinators. I think North Turner is that person. Some of them can go to the Hall of Fame as coordinators. And they might get kicked in the net as coaches. But Wade Phillips is one of the great defensive coordinators, great assistant coaches. And I don't trust Flacco. But I think there might be enough plays made that I got to go with the Ravens. But this is going to be close. It's going to scare some people. I think John Harbaugh and Ray Lewis are going to will their team to win. But I think this one might be better or closer than people think. So that's our pick four for this week. We want to hit dogs of the week right now so that we can close this out on dogs of the week.
Catch them going crazy in there. And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
Well, the game changer isn't here, but in spirit, you know, this is a segment that was first by him, but we got to hit his spirit. You know, he's out coaching like Phil, yelling at all young ladies, the next Maya Moores coming down the floor. But Jim Irsay was his dog of the week for being a shrewd businessman, and I agree with this, and really deciding to go with luck publicly and really trying to move the organization forward. It takes a lot for an owner in this day and age to make that kind of move and move away from, you know, hooligans who have such a reputation throughout the NFL to do that took a little bit of courage. So that's his dog of the week. Phil, who are your dog of the week?
My dog of the week is going with Barry Larkin. He was the only person selected to the Baseball Hall of Fame earlier this week. I've always respected Barry Larkin, the way he carried himself, played many years with the Cincinnati Reds. Before that, he played for University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. So
right.
Barry Larkin, the shortstop of the 80s and the 90s, congratulations for making the Hall of Fame.
Wow, that's a good one. Eric, do you have a dog of the week?
You know, I got to go with this guy, Tim Tebow. He was able to hush the naysayers this week by putting up a nice performance against a very tough Pittsburgh Steelers. While I will say that Pittsburgh Steelers defense totally underestimated what Tim Tebow could do, they played him like he couldn't hit man-to-man coverage. And he was able to do it. Now, while I'm not going to get along with on this, but Tim Tebow can beat man-to-man post coverage if his guy gets the inside. Phil, you could still complete that pass. But I'm saying, you know, this guy, what he did, he comes out every week, and he's not asking for all of this publicity and all of this Tim Tebow bandwagon stuff that's coming along with it. It's just happening. And for him to show that resiliency is fantastic. That's my dog.
Nice. And I would say as well that Tim Tebow is my dog of the week. Got to see the fan. I will make a criticism that I've said it for the past couple of years, that the Steelers need to upgrade at corner. I've said it for the past couple of years. It's dominant. People talk about their defense. Their corners are subpar. And that's a problem, and it showed up on Sunday, and they need to work on the running game. Having said that, like I said about Cam Newton, how you deal with pressure when your back is against the wall and trying to find a way to get done, this kid steps up. And, Eric, I think you said it best. In some ways, we got to be careful about criticizing him because he's not the one talking.
Mm-hmm.
It's everybody around him talking. And all he's doing is just coming and doing what he's trying to do. And he's not really saying anything. And he's not even egging it on. He's not doing anything. He's just being himself. And for that, I got to give him the dog of the week. You know, guys, this has been an incredible show. Eric, it's been a pleasure. And we definitely want to continue to build you and have you here with the RSG experience. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. You bring so much value to what we do. We definitely appreciate that. We definitely will be having you on the show again. You know that. You and the RSC family. So, you always here. You family. So we just want to say that. And Phil T, you delivered, man. We've been talking about Alan Sack. He did his thing tonight. He went above and beyond. The call of duty. And, I want to give you the final thoughts, my man, and close it out.
Great show. Doing big things. Counterfeit Amateurs, excellent book. Again, appreciate Eric for coming on. Nice job with the interview, Devon. Appreciate Dr. Alan Sack. And we'll be back on same time next week, Tuesdays, 8:30 to 10:30 Central. Take care. One song only.